said she couldn't possibly be having a baby. For answer, Sissy let out a blood-curdling yell and said that her pains were killing her. Mary looked at her thoughtfully. She didn't know what Sissy had in mind, but she did know it was useless to argue with her. If Sissy said she was going to have a baby, she was going to have a baby, and that's all there was to it. Her John protested.
But look how skinny she is. There's no baby in that belly, see?
Maybe it will come from a head. That's big enough, as one may see, said Mary Romilly.
Ah, they don't give such things, said the John.
Who are you to say? Demanded Sissy. Didn't the Virgin Mary herself get a baby without a man? If she could do it, I'm sure I could do it easier, being I'm married and have a man.
Who knows? Asked Mary.
She turned to the harassed husband and spoke gently.
There are a lot of things that men don't understand about.
She urged the confused man to forget the whole thing, eat a nice supper which she would cook for him, and then go to bed and get a good night's sleep. The puzzled man lay beside his wife throughout the night. He couldn't get a good night's sleep. From time to time, he'd rise on his elbow and stare at her. From time to time, he'd run his hand over her flat stomach. Sissy slept soundly all through the night. When he left for work the next morning, Sissy announced that he'd be a father before he returned that night.
"I give up!"
shouted the tormented man, and went off to his work in the pulp magazine house. Sissy rushed over to Lucia's house. The baby had been born just an hour after the father had left. It was a beautiful, healthy girl. Sissy was so happy. She said Lucia would have to nurse the baby for 10 days to give it a start, then she'd take it home. She went out and bought a roasting chicken and a bakery store pie. The mother cooked the chicken Italian style. Sissy trusted a bottle of Chianti wine from the Italian grocer on the block, and they all had a fine dinner. It was like a fiesta in the house. Everybody was happy. Lucia's stomach was almost flat again. There was no longer any monument to her disgrace. Now all was as it had been before, or would be when Sissy took the baby away. Sissy washed the baby every hour. She changed its shirt and band 3 times during the day. The diapers were changed every 5 minutes, whether they needed to be or not. She washed Lucia and made her clean and sweet. She brushed and brushed her hair until it glowed like satin. She couldn't do enough for Lucia and the baby. She had to tear herself away when it came time for the father's returning. The father came home and went into the dark room to give Lucia her daily food pittance. He turned up the gas and found a radiant Lucia and a fat, healthy baby sleeping contentedly at her side. He was amazed. All this on bread and water? Then fright grew on him. It was a miracle. Surely the Virgin Mary had intervened for the young mother. She had been known to work such miracles in Italy. Maybe he would be punished for treating his flesh and blood so inhumanly. Contrite, he brought her a plate heaped with spaghetti. Lucia declined it, saying she had grown used to bread and water. The mother sided with Lucia and explained that the bread and water had formed the perfect baby. More and more, the father believed a miracle had come about. Frantically, he tried to be nice to Lucia, but the family were punishing him. They wouldn't permit him to show any kindness to his daughter. Sissy was lying peacefully in bed when her John came home that evening. Jokingly, he asked,
"Did you have that baby today?"
"Yes,"
she said in a weak voice.
"Ah, go on."
"It was born an hour after you left this morning."
"It was not."
"I swear."
He looked around the room.
"Where is it then?"
"In the incubator, at Coney Island."
"In the where?"
"It was a 7 months baby, you know. Only weighed 3 pounds. That's why I didn't show."
"You lie, see?"
"As soon as I get my strength back, I'll take you to Coney Island, right to the glass case where it is."
"What are you trying to do? Drive me crazy?"
"I'm gonna bring it home in 10 days, just as soon as it grows fingernails."
She put that in on the spur of the moment.
"What's gotten into you, Sissy? You know goddamn well you didn't have a baby this morning."
"I had a baby. It weighed 3 pounds. They took it to the incubator so that it wouldn't die, and I'm going to get it back in 10 days.
"I give up! I give up!"
he shouted, and went out and got drunk. Sissy brought the baby home 10 days later. It was a big baby and weighed almost 11 pounds. Her John asserted himself for the last time.
"It seems mighty big for a 10-day-old baby."
"You're a mighty big man yourself, lover,"
she whispered. She saw a pleased look come into his face. She put her arms around him.
I'm all right now, she said in his ear. If you want to sleep with me.
You know, he said afterwards, it does look a little like me.
Especially around the ears, murmured Sissy drowsily.
The Italian family went back to Italy a few months later. They were glad to go because the New World had brought them nothing but sorrow, poverty, and shame. Sissy never heard of them again. Everybody knew that it wasn't Sissy's baby, that it couldn't be her baby, but she stuck to her story, and since there was no other explanation, people had to accept it. After all, strange things did happen in the world. She christened the child Sarah, but in time, everyone called it Little Sissy. Katie was the only one to whom Sissy told the truth about the origin of the baby. She confided in her when she asked her to write out the names for the birth certificate. Ah, but Francie knew too. Often in the night, she had been wakened by the sound of voices and heard Mama and Aunt Sissy talking in the kitchen about the baby. Francie vowed always to keep Sissy's secret. Johnny was the only other person, outside of the Italian family, who knew. Katie told him. Francie heard them talking about it when they thought she was sound asleep. Papa took the part of Sissy's husband. That's a dirty trick to play on a man, any man. Somebody ought to tell him. I'll tell him.
No, said Mama sharply. He's a happy man. Let him be that way. Happy? With another man's child palmed off on him?
I don't see it.
He's crazy for Sissy. He's always afraid she's going to leave him, and he'd die if she left him. And you know Sissy, she went from one man to another, one husband to another, always trying to get a child. She was on the verge of leaving this one when the baby happened along. Sissy will be a different woman from now on. Mark my words, she'll settle down at last and make him a much better wife than he deserves to have. Who is this John, anyhow?
She interrupted herself.
She'll be a good mother. The child will be her whole world, and she won't need to be going after the men anymore. So don't monkey around with it, Johnny.
You Romilly women are too deep for us men, decided Johnny. A thought struck him.
Say, you didn't do that to me, did you?
In answer, Katie got the children out of bed. She had them stand before him in their long white nightgowns. Look at them, she commanded. Johnny looked at his son. It was as if he were looking in a trick mirror where he saw himself perfectly but on a smaller scale. He looked at Francie. There was Katie's face all over again, only more solemn, except for the eyes. They were Johnny's eyes. On an impulse, Francie picked up a plate and held it over her heart the way Johnny held his hat when he sang. She sang one of his songs. They called her Frivolous Sal, a peculiar sort of a gal. She had Johnny's expressions and Johnny's gestures.
I know,
Papa whispered. He kissed his children, gave them each a pat on the backside, and told them to go back to bed. After they had gone, Katie pulled Johnny's head down and whispered something to him.
No,
he said in a surprised voice.
Yes, Johnny, she said quietly.
He put his hat on.
Where are you going, Johnny?
Out.
Johnny, please don't come home.
She looked towards the bedroom door. I won't, Katie, he promised. He kissed her gently and went out. Francie woke up in the middle of the night wondering what had taken her out of her sleep.
Ah, Papa hadn't come home yet. That was it.
She never slept soundly until she knew he had come home. Once awake, she started thinking. She thought of Sissy's baby. She thought of birth. Her thoughts went to birth's corollary, death. She didn't want to think of death, how everybody was born but to die. While she was fighting off thoughts of death, they heard Papa coming up the stairs singing softly. She shivered when she heard that he was singing the last verse of Molly Malone.
He never sang that verse. Never. Why?
She died of a fever, and no one could save her. And that's how I lost sweet Molly Malone. Francie didn't stir. It was a rule that when Papa came home late, Mama was to open the door. She didn't want the children to lose their sleep. The song was coming to an end. Mama didn't hear. She wasn't getting up. Francie jumped out of bed. The song was ended before she reached the door. When she opened it, Papa was standing there quietly, his hat in his hand. He was looking straight before him, over her head.
"You won, Papa,"
she said. "Did I?" he asked. He walked into the room, not looking at her.
"You finished the song?"
"Yes. I finished the song, I guess." He sat in the chair by the window.
"Papa?"
"Turn out the light and go back to bed." The light was kept burning low against his return. She turned out the light.
"Papa? Are you sick?"
"No, I'm not drunk," he said clearly from the dark. And Francie knew that he spoke the truth. She went to bed and buried her face in the pillow. She did not know why, but she wept. Once more, it was in the week before Christmas. Francie had just had her 14th birthday. Neely, as he put it, was waiting to turn 13 any moment. It looked as though it wouldn't be such a good Christmas. There was something wrong with Johnny. Johnny wasn't drinking. There had been other times, of course, when Johnny stopped drinking, but that was when he was working. Now he wasn't drinking at all, and he wasn't working. And the wrong thing about Johnny was that he wasn't drinking, but he was acting like he was drinking. He hadn't spoken to his family in more than 2 weeks. Francie remembered the last time Papa had said anything to her was that night when he came home sober singing the last verse of Molly Malone. Come to think of it, he hadn't sung since that night either. He came and went without speaking. He stayed out late nights and came home sober, and nobody knew where he spent that time. His hands were trembling badly. He could hardly hold the fork when he ate. And suddenly, he looked very old. Yesterday, he had come in while they were eating supper. He looked at them as though he were going to say something. Instead of speaking, however, he closed his eyes for a second and then went into the bedroom. He had no regular hours for anything. He came and went at odd hours of the day and night. When he was home, he spent the time lying on his bed, fully clothed, with his eyes shut. Katie went about white and quiet. There was a foreboding about her, as though she were carrying tragedy within herself. Her face was thin, and there were hollows under her cheeks, but her body was fuller. She had taken an extra job in this week before Christmas. She got up earlier and worked faster at her flat cleaning, and was finished in early afternoon. She rushed down to Gorling's, the department store at the Polish end of Grand Street, where she worked from 4 to 7, serving coffee and sandwiches to the salesgirls, who were not allowed to take the time to go out for supper on account of the Christmas rush. Her family desperately needed that 75 cents that she earned each day. It was nearly 7 o'clock. Neely had come home from his paper route, and Francie was back from the library. There was no fire in the flat. They had to wait until Mama came home with some money with which to buy a bundle of wood. The children wore their coats and zitful caps as it was very cold in the flat. Francie saw that Mama had wash on the line, and she pulled it in. The garments had frozen into grotesque shapes and didn't want to come in through the window.
"Here, let me at 'em," said Neely, referring to a frozen suit of underwear.
The legs of the long drawers had frozen in a spread-out position, and Neely's struggles did no good.
"I'll break the damn thing's legs," said Francie.
She whacked it fiercely, and it crackled and collapsed. She pulled it in viciously. She looked like Katie at that moment.
"Francie?"
"Huh?"
You cursed."
"I know it."
"God heard you."
"Oh, shoot."
"Yes, he did. He sees and he hears everything.
Neely, do you believe that he looks right in this little old room?"
"You betcha he does."
"Don't you believe it, Neely. He's too busy watching all the little sparrows fall and worrying about whether the little buds will burst into flowers to have time to investigate us."
"Don't talk like that, Francie."
"I will so. If he went around looking into people's windows like you say, he'd see how things were here. He'd see that it was cold and that there was no food in the house. He'd see that Mama isn't strong enough to work so hard. And he'd see how Papa was, and he'd do something about Papa. Yes, he would."
"Francie."
The boy looked around the room uneasily. Francie saw that he was uneasy. "I'm getting too big to tease him," she thought. Aloud she said, "All right, Neely." They talked about other things until Katie came home. Katie came in with a rush. She had a bundle of woodblocks which she had bought for 2 cents, a can of condensed milk, and 3 bananas in a bag. She stuffed paper and the wood into the range and had a fire going in no time. "Well, children, I guess we'll have to have oatmeal for supper tonight."
"Again?" groaned Francie.
"It won't be so bad," said Mama. "We have condensed milk and I brought bananas to slice on top."
"Mama," ordered Neely,
"don't mix my condensed milk with the oatmeal. Let it stay on top."
"Slice the bananas and cook them with the oatmeal," suggested Francie.
"I want to eat my banana whole," protested Neely.
Mama settled the argument. "I'll give you each a banana and you eat it the way you want." When the oatmeal was cooked, Katie filled two soup plates full, set them on the table, punched two holes in the can of milk, and set a banana by each plate.
"Aren't you going to eat, Mama?"
asked Neely.
"I'll eat after. I'm not hungry now," Katie sighed.
Francie said,
"Mama, if you don't feel like eating, why don't you play the piano so it's like a restaurant while we're eating?"
"It's cold in the front room."
"Light the oil stove," chorused the children.
"All right." Katie took a portable oil stove from the cupboard. "Only you know I don't play so good."
"You play grand, Mama," said Francie sincerely.
Katie was pleased. She knelt to light the oil stove.
"What do you want me to play?"
"Come, little leaves," called Francie. "Welcome, sweet springtime," shouted Neely.
"I'll play Little Leaves first," decided Mama, "because I didn't give Francie a birthday present."
She went into the cold front room.
"I think I'll slice my banana on top of my oatmeal. I'll slice it very thin so that there's a whole lot of it," said Francie.
"I'm going to eat mine whole," decided Neely, "and slow, so that it lasts a long time."
Mama was playing Francie's song now. It was one that Mr. Morton had taught the children. She sang to the music. "Come, little leaves," said the wind one day, "come o'er the meadows with me and play. Put on your dresses of red and gold."
"Ah, that's a baby song," interrupted Neely.
Francie stopped singing. When Katie finished Francie's song, she started to play Rubinstein's Melody in F. Mr. Morton had taught them that song, too, calling it Welcome, Sweet Springtime. Neely started to sing.
"Welcome, sweet springtime, we greet thee in song."
His voice changed suddenly from tenor to bass on the high note in song. Francie giggled, and soon Neely was giggling so much that he couldn't sing.
"You know what Mama would say if she was sitting here now?" asked Francie.
"What?"
"She'd say, 'Spring will be here before you know it.'"
They laughed.
"Christmas is coming soon," commented Neely.
"Remember when we were children,"
said Francie, who had just finished being 13,
"how we used to smell if Christmas was coming?"
"Let's see if we can still smell it," Neely said impulsively.
He opened the window a crack and put his nose to it.
"Yep." "What does it smell like?"
"I smell snow. Remember how when we were kids we used to look up at the sky and holler, 'Feather boy, shake down some feathers from the sky.' And when it snowed, we thought there was a feather boy up there. Let me smell," she asked suddenly.
She put her nose to the crack.
"Yes, I can smell it. It smells like orange peels and Christmas trees put together."
They closed the window. "I never snitched on you that time you got the doll when you said your name was Mary."
"No," said Francie gratefully.
"And I didn't tell on you either.
The time you made a cigarette out of coffee grounds, and when you smoked it, the paper caught fire and fell on your blouse and burned a big hole in it. I helped you hide it."
"You know," mused Neely, "Mama found that blouse and sewed a patch over the hole, and she never asked me about it."
"Mama is funny," said Francie.
They pondered a while over their mother's inscrutable ways. The fire was dying down now, but the kitchen was still warm. Neely sat on top of the far end of the stove, where it wasn't so hot. Mama had warned him that he'd get piles from sitting on a hot stove, but Neely didn't care. He liked his backside to be warm. The children were almost happy. The kitchen was warm, and they were fed, and Mama's playing made them seem safe and comfortable. They reminisced about past Christmases, or, as Francie put it, they talked about olden times. While they were talking, someone pounded on the door.
"It's Papa," said Francie.
"No, Papa always sings coming up the stairs, so we know it's him."
"Neely, Papa hasn't sung coming home since that night."
"Let me in,"
shouted Johnny's voice, and he beat on the door as though he would break it down. Mama came running out from the front room. Her eyes looked very dark in her white face. She opened the door. Johnny lunged in. They stared at him. They had never seen Papa looking like that. He was always so neat, and now his tuxedo jacket was dirty, as though he had been lying in the gutter, and his derby hat was bashed in. He didn't own an overcoat or gloves. His cold red hands were trembling. He lunged to the table.
"No, I'm not drunk,"
he said.
"Nobody said," began Katie.
"At last I'm through with it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it."
He pounded the table. They knew he was speaking the truth.
"I haven't touched a drop since that night,"
he broke off suddenly.
"But no one would believe me anymore. No one."
"There, Johnny," said Mama soothingly.
"What's the matter, Papa?" asked Francie.
"Shh! Don't bother your father," said Mama.
She spoke to Johnny.
"There's coffee left from this morning, Johnny. It's nice and hot, and we've got milk tonight. I was waiting until you came home so that we could eat together."
She poured coffee.
"We ate already," said Neely.
"Hush,"
Mama told him.
She put milk into the coffee and sat opposite Johnny. "Drink it, Johnny, while it's hot."
Johnny stared at the cup. Suddenly he pushed it from him, and Katie drew a sharp breath as it clattered to the floor. Johnny buried his head in his arms and sobbed shudderingly. Katie went to him.
"What's the matter, Johnny? What's the matter?"
she asked soothingly. Finally, he sobbed out.
"They threw me out of the waiters' union today. They said I was a bum and a drunk. They said they'd never give me another job as long as I live."
He controlled his sobs for a moment, and his voice was frightened as he said,
"As long as I live."
He wept bitterly.
"They wanted me to turn in my union button."
He put his hand over the tiny green and white button he wore in his lapel. Francie's throat got tight as she remembered how he often said he wore it like an ornament, a rose. He was so proud to be a union man.
"But I wouldn't give it up,"
he sobbed.
"That's nothing, Johnny. You just get a good rest, and get on your feet again, and they'll be glad to take you in. You're a good waiter and the best singer they've got."
"I'm no good anymore. I can't sing anymore. Katie, they laugh at me now when I sing. The last few jobs I had, they hired me to give the people a laugh. It's come to that now. I'm finished."
He sobbed wildly. He sobbed as though he never could stop. Francie wanted to run into the bedroom and hide her head under the pillow. She edged toward the door. Mama saw her.
"Stay here,"
she said sharply. She spoke to Papa again.
"Come, Johnny. Rest a while and you'll feel better. The oil stove is lit, and I'll put it in the bedroom and it will be nice and warm. I'll sit with you until you fall asleep."
She put her arms around him. Gently he put her arms away and went into the bedroom alone, sobbing more quietly. Katie spoke to the children.
"I'm going to stay with Papa for a while. Keep on talking or doing whatever you were doing."
The children stared at her numbly.
"What are you looking at me like that for?"
Her voice broke.
"Nothing's the matter."
They looked away. She went into the front room to get the oil stove. Francie and Neely did not look at each other for a long time.
Finally, he said, "Do you want to talk about olden times?"
"No,"
said Francie. Johnny died 3 days later. He had gone to bed that night, and Katie had sat by him until he went to sleep. Later she slept with Francie so as not to disturb him. Sometime during the night he got up, dressed quietly, and went out. He did not return the next night. The second day, they began looking for him. They looked all over, but Johnny hadn't been in any of his accustomed haunts for a week. The second night, McShane came over to take Katie to a nearby Catholic hospital. On the way over, he told her, as gently as he could, about Johnny. Johnny had been found early that morning, huddled in a doorway. He was unconscious when a cop found him. His tuxedo jacket was buttoned up over his undershirt, and the cop saw the St. Anthony's medal around his neck and called up the Catholic Hospital ambulance. There were no marks of identification on him. Later the cop made his report at the station house and gave a description of the unconscious man. In the routine of checking the reports, McShane came across the description. His sixth sense told him who the man was. He went to the hospital and saw that it was Johnny Nolan. Johnny was still living when Katie got there. He had pneumonia, the doctor told her, and there wasn't a chance. It was merely a question of hours. Already he was in the coma that came before death. They took Katie to him. His bed was in a long corridor-like ward. There were 50 other beds in the ward. Katie thanked McShane and said goodbye. He went away knowing that she wanted to be alone with Johnny. There was a screen, connoting dying, around Johnny's bed. They brought a chair for Katie, and she sat there all day, watching him. He was breathing harshly, and there were dried tears on his face. Katie stayed there until he died. He had never opened his eyes. He had not spoken a word to his wife. It was night when she came home. She decided not to tell the children until the morning. Let them have a night's sleep behind them, she thought. One more night of griefless sleep. She told them only that their father was in the hospital and very sick. She said no more. There was something about the way she looked that discouraged the children from asking questions. Just as dawn came, Francie woke. She looked across the narrow bedroom and saw Mama sitting next to Neely's bed and looking down into his face. Her eyes were dark underneath, and she looked as though she had been sitting there all night. When she saw that Francie was awake, she told her to get up and get dressed right away. She shook Neely gently to awaken him and told him the same thing. She went out into the kitchen. The bedroom was gray and cold, and Francie shivered as she got into her clothes. She waited for Neely, not wanting to go out to Mama alone. Katie was sitting by the window. They came before her and stood waiting. "Your father is dead," she told them. Francie stood numb. There was no feeling of surprise or grief. There was no feeling of anything. What Mama just said had no meaning. "You're not to cry for him," ordered Mama. Her next words had no sense either. "He's out of it now, and maybe he's luckier than we are." An orderly at the hospital was in the pay of an undertaker whom he notified as soon as a death occurred. This wide-awake undertaker gained an advantage over his competitors in that he went after the business while the others waited for the business to come after them. This enterprising fellow called on Katie early in the morning. "Mrs. Nolan," he said, surreptitiously referring to the slip of paper on which the orderly had written her name and address. "I sympathize with you in your great grief. I give you a thought. What has come to you has to come to all of us." "What do you want?" asked Katie bluntly. "To be your friend," he hurried on before she could misunderstand. "There are details connected with, the remains, I mean," again a quick look at the slip. "I mean Mr. Nolan. I ask you to look on me as a friend who brings comfort at a time when, I want you to leave everything in my hands." Katie understood. "How much would you charge for a simple funeral?" "Now don't you worry about costs," he hedged. "I'll give him a fine funeral. There's no man I respected more than Mr. Nolan." He had never known Mr. Nolan. "I'll make it my personal business to see that he gets the best there is. Don't worry about the money." "I won't, because there's none to worry about." He wet his lips. "Aside from the insurance money, of course?" It was a question, not a statement. "There's insurance. A little." "Ah," he rubbed his hands together happily. "There's where I can be of service. There's red tape connected with collecting insurance. Take a long time before you get the money. Now, supposing you, and understand I'm not charging you for this, let me take care of it. You just sign this." He whisked a paper out of his pocket. "Turning your policy over to me. I'll advance the money and collect on the policy." All undertakers gave this service. It was a trick, to ascertain how much insurance there was. Once they knew the amount, the funeral cost 80% of it. They had to leave a little money for mourning clothes to keep the people satisfied. Katie got the policy. As she put it on the table, his practice eye picked out the amount, $200. He appeared not to have looked at the policy. After Katie had signed the paper, he talked of other things for a while. Finally, as if coming to a decision, he said, "Tell you what I'll do, Mrs. Nolan. I'll give the departed a first-class four-coach funeral with a nickel-handle coffin for $175. That's my regular $250 job, and I'm not making a penny on it."
"Why are you doing it then for?" asked Katie.
He wasn't at all put out. "I'm doing it because I liked Mr. Nolan. A splendid man, and a hard-working man." He noticed the surprised look Katie gave him.
"I don't know," she hesitated. "$175.
That includes the mass, too," he put in hastily.
"All right," said Katie dully.
She was tired of talking about it. The undertaker picked up the policy and pretended to see the amount for the first time.
"Say, this is for $200, he said in stagey surprise. "That means you got $25 coming to you after the funeral is paid."
He dug into his pocket, stretching his leg out straight before him to do so. "Well, I always say that a little cash comes in handy at a time like this. At any time, if you ask me," he chuckled understandingly. "So I'll just advance you the balance out of my own pocket." He put $25 in new bills on the table. Katie thanked him. He wasn't fooling her, but she made no protest. She knew that was the way things were done. He was only working at his trade. He asked her to get the death certificate from the officiating doctor. "And please inform them that I'll call for the I'll come and get Mr. Nolan." When Katie went to the hospital again, she was taken to the doctor's office. The priest of the parish was there. He was trying to supply information for the making out of the death certificate. When he saw Katie, he made the sign of the cross in blessing, and then shook her hand. "Mrs. Nolan can tell you more than I can," said the priest. The doctor asked necessary questions, the full name and place of birth and date of birth and so on. Finally, Katie asked him a question. "What are you writing down there? What he died from, I mean?" "Acute alcoholism and pneumonia." "They say he died of pneumonia." "That was the direct cause of death. But this acute alcoholism was a definite contributing factor, probably the main cause of death, if you wish the truth." "I don't want you to write down," said Katie slowly and steadily, "that he died from drinking too much. Write that he died of pneumonia alone."
"Madam, I have to state the entire truth."
"He's dead. What can it mean to you what he died of?" "The law requires..." "Look," said Katie, "I got two nice children. They're gonna grow up to amount to something. It isn't their fault that their father..." "That he died from what you said. It would mean a lot to me if I could tell them that their father died of pneumonia alone." The priest took a hand in it. "You can do it, doctor," he said, "without hurt to yourself and with benefit to others. Don't be kicking around of a poor lad that's dead and gone. Write down pneumonia, which is no lie, and this lady will be remembering you in her prayers for a long time to come. Besides," he added practically, "it's no skin off your teeth." All of a sudden, the doctor recalled two things. He remembered that the priest was a member of the hospital board, and he remembered that he liked being head doctor at that particular hospital.
"All right," he conceded. "I'll do it, but don't let it get around. It's a personal favor to you, Father."
He wrote down pneumonia in the blank after cause of death. And it was nowhere on record that John Nolan had died a drunkard. Katie used the $25 to buy mourning clothes. She bought Neely a new black suit with long pants. It was his first long-pants suit, and pride, pleasure, and grief fought in Neely's heart. For herself, Katie got a new black hat and a 3-foot widow's veil according to the custom of Brooklyn. Francie got new shoes, which she had been needing for a long time anyhow. It was decided not to buy Francie a black coat, as she was growing fast and it wouldn't fit her next winter. Mama said her old green coat would do, with a black band around the arm. Francie was glad because she hated black and had worried lest her mother put her in deep mourning. The little money left over after the shopping was finished was put in the tin can bank. The undertaker came again to report that Johnny was at his funeral parlor and was being fixed up fine and would be brought home that evening. Katie told him, rather sharply, not to give them the details. Then the blow fell.
Mrs. Nolan, I have to have the deed to your lot.
What lot?
The cemetery plot. I need the deed to get the grave opened.
I thought that was all in the $175.
No, no, no. I'm giving you a bargain. The coffin alone cost me.
I don't like you, said Katie in her blunt way. I don't like the business you're in. But then, she added with her amazing detachment, I suppose someone has to bury the dead.
How much is a plot?
$20.
Where in the world would I get...
She stopped short. Francie, get the screwdriver. They pried up the tin can bank. There was $18.62 in it.
It's not enough, said the undertaker, but I'll lay out the rest.
He held out his hand for the money. I'll get all the money together, Katie told him, but I'll not turn over the money until I have the deed in my hand. He fussed and argued and finally went away saying he'd bring back the deed. Mama sent Francie over to Sissy's house to borrow $2. When the undertaker came back with the deed, Katie, remembering something her mother had said 14 years ago, read it slowly and carefully. She made Francie and Neely read it too. The undertaker stood first on one foot, then on the other. When all three Nolans were satisfied that the deed was in order, Katie handed over the money.
"Why should I want to cheat you, Mrs. Nolan?" he asked plaintively as he put the money away carefully.
"Why should anyone want to cheat anybody?" she asked in return. "But they do." The tin can bank stood in the middle of the table. It was 14 years old, and its strips were battered.
"Do you want me to nail it back down, Mama?" asked Francie.
"No," said Mama slowly. "We won't need it any more. You see, we own a bit of land now." She placed the folded deed on top of the clumsy star bank. Francie and Neely remained out in the kitchen all the time the coffin was in the front room. They even slept in the kitchen. They didn't want to see their father in the coffin. Katie seemed to understand and did not insist that they go in and look at their father. The house was full of flowers. The Waiters' Union, which had thrown Johnny out less than a week before, sent around an enormous pillow of white carnations with a purple ribbon running diagonally across it, on which were the words in gold letters, "Our Brother." The cops from the precinct, in memory of the capture of the murderer, sent a cross of red roses. Sergeant McShane sent a sheaf of lilies. Johnny's mother, the Romilies, and some of the neighbors sent flowers. There were flowers from dozens of Johnny's friends that Katie had never heard of. McGarity, the saloon keeper, sent a wreath of artificial laurel leaves. "I'd throw it in the ash can," said Evie indignantly when she read the card.
"No," said Katie gently. "I can't blame McGarity. Johnny didn't have to go there."
Johnny owed McGarity over $38 at the time of his death. For some reason, the saloon keeper said nothing to Katie about it. He canceled the debt silently. The flat was sickly with the combined scents of roses, lilies, and carnations. Forever after, Francie hated those flowers, but it pleased Katie to know how much people had thought of Johnny. A few moments before they were to close the coffin lid on Johnny, Katie came out to the kitchen to the children. She put her hands on Francie's shoulders and spoke low.
"I heard some neighbors whispering. They said you won't look at your father because he wasn't a good father to you."
"He was a good father," said Francie fiercely.
"Yes, he was," agreed Katie.
She waited, letting the children make their own decision.
"Come on, Neely," said Francie.
Hand in hand, the children went in to their father. Neely looked quickly, then afraid he would start crying, he ran out of the room. Francie stood there with her eyes on the ground, afraid to look. Finally, she lifted her eyes.
She couldn't believe that Papa wasn't living.
He wore his tuxedo suit, which had been cleaned and pressed. He had on a fresh dickey and collar, and a carefully tied bow tie. There was a carnation in his lapel, and above it, his union button. His hair was shining and golden and as curling as ever. One of the locks was out of place, and had fallen down on the side of his forehead a little. His eyes were closed as though he were sleeping lightly. He looked young and handsome and well cared for. She noticed for the first time how finely arched his eyebrows were. His small mustache was trimmed and looked as debonair as ever. All the pain and grief and worry had left his face. It was smooth and boyish-looking. Johnny was 34 years old when he died, but he looked younger now, like a boy just past 20. Francie looked at his hands, crossed so casually over a silver crucifix. There was a circlet of whiter skin on his third finger, where he used to wear the signet ring that Katie had given him when they married. Katie had taken it off to give to Neely when he grew up. It was queer to see Papa's hands so quiet, when she remembered them as always trembling. Francie noticed how narrow and sensitive-looking they were, with the long and tapering fingers. She stared steadily at his hands, and thought she saw them move. Panic churned up in her, and she wanted to run away. But the room was full of people watching her. They would say she was running away because... he had been a good father. He had. He had. She put her hand on his hair and put the lock back in place. Aunt Sissy came and put her arm around her and whispered, "It's time." Francie stepped back to stand with Mama while they closed the lid. At the Mass, Francie knelt on one side of Mama and Neely on the other. Francie kept her eyes on the floor so that she wouldn't have to look at the flower-covered coffin standing on trestles before the altar. Once she stole a look at her mother. Katie was kneeling, staring straight ahead, her face white and quiet under the widow's veil. When the priest stepped down and walked around the coffin sprinkling holy water at the four corners of it, a woman sitting across the aisle sobbed wildly. Katie, jealous and fiercely possessive even in death, turned sharply to look at the woman who dared weep for Johnny. She looked well at the woman, then turned her head away. Her thoughts were like torn bits of paper blowing around. "Hildy O'Dea is old for her age," she thought. "It's like powder was sprinkled on her yellow hair. But she's not much older than me. 32 or 33. She was 18 when I was 17. You go your way, and I'll go my way. You mean you'll go her way? Hildy. Hildy. He's my fella, Katie Romilly. Hildy. Hildy. But she's my best friend. I'm not much good, Hildy. I shouldn't have led you on. You go your. Hildy. Hildy. Let her cry. Let her cry," thought Katie. "Someone who loved Johnny should cry for him, and I can't cry. Let her." Katie, Johnny's mother, and Francie and Neely rode out to the cemetery in the first coach behind the hearse. The children sat with their backs to the driver. Francie was glad because she couldn't see the hearse which led the procession. She saw the coach which followed. Aunt Evie and Aunt Sissy were in that one alone. Their husbands couldn't come because they were working, and Grandma Mary Romilly was staying home to mind Sissy's new baby. Francie wished she were riding in the second coach. Ruthie Nolan wept and lamented during the whole of the ride. Katie sat in stony quiet. The carriage was close and smelt of damp hay and stale horse manure. The smell, the closeness, the riding backwards and the tension gave Francie an unfamiliar feeling of sickness. At the cemetery, there was a plain wooden box standing beside a deep hole. They put the cloth-covered casket with its shiny handles into the plain box. Francie looked away when they lowered it into the grave. It was a gray day, and a chill wind was blowing. Little whirls of frozen dust eddied about Francie's feet. A short distance away, at a week-old grave, some men were stripping the withered flowers from the wire frames of the floral pieces heaped on the grave. They worked methodically, keeping the withered flowers in a neat heap and piling up the wire frames carefully. Theirs was a legitimate business. They bought this concession from the cemetery officials and sold the wire frames to the florists, who used them over and over again. No one complained because the men were very scrupulous about not tearing off the flowers until they were well withered. Someone pushed a lump of cold, damp earth into Francie's hand. She saw that Mama and Neely were standing at the edge of the grave and dropping their handful of earth into it. Francie walked slowly to the edge, closed her eyes, and opened her hand slowly. She heard a soft thud after a second, and that feeling of sickness came back again. After the burial, the coaches went in different directions. Each mourner was to be taken to his own home. Ruthie Nolan went off with some mourners who lived near her. She didn't even say goodbye. All during the services, she had refused to speak to Katie and the children. And Sissy and Evie got into the carriage with Katie and Francie and Neely. There wasn't room for five people, so Francie had to sit on Evie's lap. They were all very quiet on the way home. Aunt Evie tried to cheer them up by telling some new stories about Uncle Willie and his horse, but no one smiled because no one listened. Mama made the coach stop at a barber shop around the corner from their house. "Go in there," she told Francie, "and get your father's cup." Francie didn't know what she meant. "What cup?" she asked. "Just ask for his cup." Francie went in. There were two barbers, but no customers. One of the barbers sat on one of the chairs in a row against the wall. His left ankle rested on his right knee, and he cradled a mandolin. He was playing O Sole Mio. Francie knew the song. Mr. Morton had taught it to them, saying the title was Sunshine. The other barber was sitting in one of the barber chairs, looking at himself in the long mirror. He got down from the chair as the girl came in.
"Yes?"
he asked. "I want my father's cup."
"The name?"
"John Nolan."
"Ah, yes, sir. Too bad."
He sighed as he took a mug from the row of them on a shelf. It was a thick white mug with John Nolan written on it in gold and fancy block letters. There was a worn-down cake of white soap at the bottom of it and a tired-looking brush. He pried out the soap and put it and the brush in a bigger, unlettered cup. He washed Johnny's cup. While Francie waited, she looked around. She had never been inside a barber shop. It smelled of soap and clean towels and bay rum. There was a gas heater which hissed companionably. The barber had finished the song and started it over again. The thin tinkle of the mandolin made a sad sound in the warm shop. Francie sang Mr. Morton's words to the song in her mind. "Oh, what's so fine, dear, as a day of sunshine. The storm is past at last. The sky is blue and clear." "Everyone has a secret life," she mused. Papa never spoke about the barber shop, yet he had come here 3 times a week to be shaved. Fastidious Johnny had bought his own cup, emulating men who were in better circumstances. He wouldn't be shaved with lather from the common cup. Not Johnny. He had come there 3 times a week, when he had the money, and sat in one of those chairs, and looked in that mirror and talked with the barber about, maybe, whether the Brooklyns had a good ball team that year, or whether the Democrats would get in as usual. Perhaps he had sung when that other barber played the mandolin. Yes, she was sure that he had sung. Singing had come easier than breathing to him. She wondered if, when he had to wait, he read the Police Gazette lying on that bench. The barber gave her the washed and dried cup. "Johnny Nolan was a fine fella," he said. "Tell the mama that I, his barber, said this." "Thank you," whispered Francie gratefully. She went out, closing the door on the sad sound of the mandolin. Back in the coach, she held out the cup to Katie.
"That's for you to have," said Mama.
"Neely will have Papa's signet ring." Francie looked at her father's name in gold and whispered, "Thank you," gratefully for the second time in 5 minutes. Johnny had been on Earth for 34 years. Less than a week ago, he had walked on those streets. And now the cup, the ring, and 2 unironed waiter's aprons at home were the only concrete objects left to connote that a man had once lived. There were no other physical reminders of Johnny, as he had been buried in all the clothes he owned, with his studs and his 14-carat gold collar button. When they got home, they found that the neighbors had been in and straightened up the flat. The furniture had been put back in place in the front room, and the withered leaves and fallen flower petals swept out. The windows had been opened and the rooms aired out. They had brought coal and made a great fire in the kitchen range and put a fresh white cloth on the table. The Tinmore girls had brought up a cake which they had baked themselves, and it stood on a plate and was already sliced. Floss Gaddis and her mother had bought a whole lot of sliced bologna. It took 2 plates to hold it. There was a basket of freshly sliced rye bread, and the coffee cups were set out on the table. There was a pot full of freshly made coffee warming on the stove, and someone had set a pitcher of real cream in the middle of the table. They had done all this while the Nolans were away. Then they had left, locked the door behind them, and put the key under the mat. Aunt Sissy, Evie, Mama, Francie, and Neely sat at the table. Aunt Evie poured out the coffee. Katie sat for a long time looking at her cup. She remembered the last time Johnny had sat at that table. She did what Johnny had done. She pushed the cup away with her arm, put her head down on the table, and cried in great, ugly, tearing sobs. Sissy put her arms around her and spoke in her gentle, caressing voice.
"Katie, Katie, don't cry so. Don't cry so. Else the child you'll soon be bringing into this world will be a sad child."
Katie stayed in bed the day after the funeral, and Francie and Neely wandered around the flat stunned and bewildered. Towards evening, Katie got up and made some supper for them. After they had eaten, she urged the children to go for a little walk, saying they needed the air. Francie and Neely walked up Graham Avenue towards Broadway. It was a bitterly cold and still night, but there was no snow. The streets were empty. It was 3 days after Christmas, and children were home playing with their new toys. The streetlights were bleak and bright. A small icy wind coming in from the sea blew close to the ground. It whirled bits of dirty papers along the gutters. They had grown out of childhood in the last few days. Christmas as Christmas had passed unnoticed since their father had died on Christmas Day. Neely's 13th birthday had been lost somewhere in those last few days. They came to the brilliantly lighted facade of a big vaudeville house. Since they were reading children and read everything they came across, they stopped and automatically read the list of acts playing that week. Underneath the sixth act was an announcement in large letters. "Here, next week, Chauncey Osborne, sweet singer of sweet songs. Don't miss him." Sweet singer. Sweet singer. Francie had not shed a tear since her father's death. Neither had Neely. Now Francie felt that all the tears she had were frozen together in her throat in a solid lump, and the lump was growing. Growing. She felt that if the lump didn't melt soon and change back into tears, she too would die. She looked at Neely. Tears were falling out of his eyes. Then her tears came too. They turned into a dark side street and sat on the edge of the sidewalk with their feet in the gutter. Neely, though weeping, remembered to spread his handkerchief on the curb so that his new long pants wouldn't get dirty. They sat close together because they were cold and lonesome. They wept long and quietly, sitting there in the cold street. At last, when they could cry no more, they talked.
"Neely, why did Papa have to die?"
"I guess God wanted him to die."
"Why?"
"Maybe to punish him."
"Punish him for what?"
"I don't know," said Neely miserably.
"Do you believe that God put Papa on this world?"
"Yes."
"Then he wanted him to live, didn't he?"
"I guess so."
"Then why did he make him die so quick?"
"Maybe to punish him," repeated Neely, not knowing what else to answer.
"If that's true, what good is it? Papa's dead, and he don't know that he's punished. God made Papa the way he was, and then said to himself, 'I dare you to do anything about it.' I just bet he said that."
"Maybe you shouldn't talk about God like that," said Neely apprehensively.
"They say God's so great," said Francie scornfully, "and knows everything and can do everything. If he's so great, why didn't he help Papa instead of punishing him like you said?"
"I just said maybe."
"If God has charge of all the world," said Francie, "and the sun and the moon and the stars and all the birds and trees and flowers and all the animals and people, you'd think he'd be too busy and too important, wouldn't you, to spend so much time punishing one man like Papa."
"I don't think you should talk about God like that," said Neely uneasily. "He might strike you down dead."
"Then let him," cried Francie fiercely. "Let him strike me down dead right here in the gutter where I sit."
They waited fearfully. Nothing happened.
When Francie spoke again, she was quieter. "I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and his mother, Holy Mary. Jesus was a living baby once. He went barefooted, like we do in the summer. I saw a picture where he was a boy and had no shoes on,
and when he was a man, he went fishing like Papa did once. And they could hurt him, too, like they couldn't hurt God. Jesus wouldn't go around punishing people. He knew about people. So I will always believe in Jesus Christ.
They made the sign of the cross, as Catholics do when mentioning Jesus' name. Then she put her hand on Neely's knee and spoke in a whisper.
Neely, I wouldn't tell anybody but you. But I don't believe in God anymore.
I want to go home,
said Neely. He was shivering.
When Katie let them in, she saw that their faces were tired, yet peaceful.
Well, they've cried it out, she thought. Francie looked at her mother, then looked away quickly. While we were gone, she thought, she cried and cried until she couldn't cry any more. The weeping wasn't mentioned aloud by any one of them.
I thought you'd come home cold, said Mama, so I made a warm surprise for you.
What?
Asked Neely.
You'll see.
The surprise was hot chocolate, which was cocoa and condensed milk made into a paste and boiling water stirred into it. Katie poured the thick, rich stuff into the cups. And that's not all, she added. She took 3 marshmallows from a paper bag in her apron pocket and popped one into each cup.
Mama!
Said the children simultaneously and ecstatically. Hot chocolate was something extra special, usually reserved for birthdays. Mama is really somebody, thought Francie, as she held her marshmallow down with her spoon and watched the melting white swirls vein the dark chocolate. She knows we've been crying, but she's not asking questions about it.
Mama never...
Suddenly the right word about Mama came to Francie. Mama never fumbles. No. Katie never fumbled. When she used her beautifully shaped but worn-looking hands, she used them with surety, whether it was to put a broken flower into a tumbler of water with one true gesture, or to wring out a scrub cloth with one decisive motion, the right hand turning in and the left out simultaneously. When she spoke truly with the plain right words, and her thoughts walked in a clear, uncompromising line. Mama was saying, Neely's getting too big to sleep in the same room with his sister, so I fixed the room your... She barely hesitated over the next word. Father and I used to have. That's Neely's bedroom now. Neely's eyes jumped to his mother's.
A room of his own. A dream come true. 2 dreams come true. Long pants and a room.
His eyes saddened then, as he thought of how these good things had come to him.
And I'll share your room, Francie.
Instinctive tact made Katie put it that way instead of saying, "You'll share my room."
I wish I had my own room, thought Francie with a flare of jealousy. But it's right, I guess, that Neely have it. There are only 2 bedrooms, and he couldn't sleep with Mama.
Knowing Francie's thought, Katie said, "And when it gets warm again, Francie can have the front room. We'll put her cot in there and put a nice cover on it in the daytime, and it will be like a private sitting room. All right, Francie?"
All right, Mama.
After a while, Mama said, We forgot the reading the last few nights, but now we'll start again.
So things will go on just the same, thought Francie, a little surprised, as she took the Bible from the mantelpiece.
Being, said Mama, though we lost Christmas this year, let's skip the part we're supposed to read and go to the birth of the baby Jesus. We'll take turns reading. You start, Francie. Francie read. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in the manger because there was no room for them in the inn. Katie sighed sharply. Francie stopped reading and looked up inquiringly.
It's nothing, said Mama. Go on reading.
No, it's nothing, Katie thought. It's the time when I should feel life.
Again the unborn child trembled faintly within her.
Was it because he knew of this coming child,
she wondered silently,
that he stopped drinking at the last?
She had whispered to him that they were to have another child.
Had he tried to be different when he knew?
And knowing, did he die in the trying to be a better man?
Johnny. Johnny.
She sighed again.
And they read, each in turn, of the birth of Jesus. And reading, they thought of Johnny dying. But each kept his thoughts.